Support for Science Questions comes from USU's College of Science, advancing the educational experience of future scientists with advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Science Questions. This is Sherry Quinn. The notion of fire conjures up images of blazing forests, sounds of sirens and burning houses, or a warm campfire or fireplace crackling with sizzling hot wood. Fire symbolizes power, destruction, comfort, and life. Though known for devastation, fire can also trigger a rebirth, providing nutrients to parched forest floors where new healthy sprouts can take root and flourish. Science Questions is exploring an artistic side today, presenting two very different stories from two very different kinds of storytellers, a scientist and a writer, who are both enchanted by the ability of fire in nature to paint an entirely new landscape. Here's the scientist.
My name's Mitchell Power, and I'm curator of the Garrett Herbarium at the Natural History Museum of Utah. And I'm also an assistant professor in the Department of Geography.
I think we all have a fascination with fire. If you spent any time around a campfire at night, we all stare into the fire, and it has a very dramatic appeal. And maybe this is part from my family background. My father is a professor of theater. We grew up in a very drama-driven household, where we were all involved in plays and Shakespeare, and you know, we did all these great things as kids. At some level, you know, my interest in fire is that it does have this very dramatic appeal, and I think that brings people in to curiosity about fire. But I think probably more importantly is that fire is a phenomena that is related to everything. Whether you have asthma and react to increased smoke from fire, or whether you grow grass seed in Oregon and burn your crops every year to rejuvenate the soil to grow more grass seed, or I mean, there's a million ways fire comes into our house or our life. You know, every organism out there has some relationship, either some strategy to take advantage of it, or a way to hide from it, or you know, response to it. So it's a very synergistic area of science.
I'm going to ask the question. Please answer if you can. Is there anybody's children can tell me? Tell me. Somebody tell me, answer if you can. I want somebody to tell me what is the soul of a man.
We are just to the south of Natural History Museum of Utah. To me, one of the coolest things about this particular location is the old shorelines that were put down by Glacial Lake Bonneville. And so just after the Ice Age ended about 20,000 years ago. And so we're actually walking right now on the shore of ancient Lake Bonneville. I'm just taking you up around behind the new museum into an area that just recently burned. And start to get a sense of what happens when a fire moves through the foothill system. Fire, in my mind, it's a necessary piece of the processes that really drive ecosystems to be healthy, maintain diversity, a variety of habitat types, different ages of regeneration. It's almost like fire comes and cleans out the closet and allows you to unpack a bunch of new and exciting things, and you can consider fire as a process across the globe. you know, the estimates range from about 250 to 500 million hectares a year. That includes everything from tropical savannas to, you know, boreal forests in Canada. That's how many acres burn every year. It's a global phenomena. We're in a stand of Gamble's Oak on the north face of the foothills here. What we see is a stand of Gamble Oaks with all the leaves on, but all the leaves have turned rust brown and died. Because this is north facing, the fire did not turn into what we call a crown fire, which is when it consumes everything. So after the ground fire came through, the shock to the oak trees caused all of this dieback in their leaves. But as we walk up in there and you look underneath the canopy, you'll see there's a new carpet of baby oak trees. And they're just what we call suckers or shooters, and they pop up from the existing oak root systems. And so there's literally millions of new oaks that have come up as a result of this fire. And it wasn't very hot when the fire burned through here, so it didn't damage the soils. So the soils are ripe. In fact, the fire's added a bit more nutrient to the soil. And it's really, you know, a perfect spot for these oaks to explode into life. All of the new sprouts you see carpeting this area are already attached to existing root systems. What fire does is it creates a mosaic of landscapes. So you have new landscapes, old landscapes. You have a rejuvenation of vegetation in one spot where fires come through recently, and then in other spots where you haven't had a fire for 100 years or 200 years, you might have some older mature trees. You can have old snags where birds like to carve holes and nest. And so it's really the mosaic, I think, is the ultimate goal of getting fire in a system. As we round the top of this hill, these curled leaves are Gamble's oak. And the Gamble's has what's called a waxy cuticle, which is like a layer of wax over the leaf itself. The oaks are quite known for their high content of what we call volatile organic compounds. As you heat oaks, and it forces those volatile organic compounds to come out, and it actually puts flammable vapors into the air. Firefighters have reported on having oaks explode into flames because the heat will force all of these organic compounds out, and then they spontaneously combust. My mantra has always been let it burn, and I guess I have mixed feelings about that. You know, on one hand, by letting fires burn now, particularly in these lower elevation settings where we've had fuel buildup and we've taken fire out for so long, the let it burn approach can often do more damage than good, because you lose habitat as opposed to gaining habitat. If you get away from these lower elevation systems, you get away from the urban wildland interface, and you get up into the mid or high elevations, when fires start there by lightning, my perspective is yes, completely let it do what it's supposed to do. And it's ultimately, it's weather that will determine when the fire goes out. So I think, you know, in an ideal sense, if we didn't have this urban wildland interface and then this historical mismanagement of low elevation forests, a let it burn approach would be ideal and create the kind of habitats that we want. But because we've messed already with the system and there's a lot of people now living in fire-prone habitats, we have to have a really mixed and adaptive management strategy. You know, and I think, too, it's a lot of just educating folks who choose to build their dream home in a chaparral, fire-prone ecosystem. Well, it's no different than building your dream home on a floodplain or on an earthquake fault. There's an inherent risk that this is part of the system, and that just be aware of that, because those processes will continue to happen. And for so long, we've been thinking of fire as a purely anthropogenic phenomena, that prehistoric people used fire, and fire was part of the Great Plains because the Plains people would have used it as a tool. But fire is really controlled by climate. People really, all they do is supplement the amount of natural fire that happens on the landscape. Using the 20th century as our base of knowledge on fire is not good enough, because we've changed our relationship with fire in the 20th century. And we refer to fires now as catastrophic. And in fact, they're not catastrophic. Fires are more of a renewal or rebirth.
That was Mitch Power, Assistant Professor of Geography at the University of Utah and a research curator at the Natural History Museum of Utah. Margie Rockland is a writer based in Los Angeles, but her heart is in a chunk of desert land 500 miles away from her house, where an experience there left her questioning science and believing in magic.
My father was born in 1922 in a three-bedroom red brick house on a hill about 3 miles outside of Nogales, a tiny town on the Arizona-Mexico border. He lived in that same house on that same hill until he was 18 years old. After that, he went to college, then he enlisted in the Air Force, then he went back to college again, which is where he met my mother. When he was 26, he and my mother moved to Los Angeles and they started a family. And eventually, Los Angeles became home. But Nogales, it was our emotional center. Today, people hear Nogales and they think drug smuggling and border fences and human trafficking. But back then, with my family, it was Mecca. And when I was about 10, during one of these visits, my father led me up to the highest point of the estate, to a pile of stone. And he told me that when he was a little boy, he named this place Lookout Rock. Then he asked me to promise that when he died, I would make sure that this became his final resting place. I'm 10 years old, I told him. Then I begged him to find someone older, someone more responsible to be in charge of something so important. But he shook his head and said no, that he was holding me to my word. And I couldn't tell if he was kidding or not, because that's the kind of thing he'd think was funny. Or maybe he was serious. I never knew. He was that kind of guy. By trade, my father was so many things, an architect, an artist, a writer. When he was in his mid-70s, he suddenly decided to become a monologuist, and he toured the country performing a one-man show about his World War II experiences. But as a man, my father was unpredictable. One minute he'd be joking, and then the next minute he'd switch gears. He'd say to total strangers, "Do you believe in God? What's your vital absorbing interest?" In 2002, after a long illness, my father passed away. Some of his ashes were buried at a cemetery in Los Angeles, and some at the Jewish cemetery in Nogales. Consensus in my family is not always easily reached, but it was decided that the remaining portion would be placed at Lookout Rock. My family and I drove up the steep hill to my grandmother's property, and we started hiking through the dry grass.
Didn't the hill used to seem like steeper?
We found the spot and gathered around the boulders.
Is this it?
Yep.
My mother poured the ashes into a hole that had been drilled into the rock.
Well, we can just put it right in.
Mom, be careful. Yeah, there's a light breeze.
I have it in plastic, in a baggie.
Oh, okay.
And my cousin David affixed a metal marker over the stone.
What do you think?
You want to say a prayer?
Want to say some?
I don't know.
Wait till he does.
Thank you, though.
Then my mother put her hand on the marker, almost as if she were touching my father, and she said, "Fred, you are finally where you've always wanted to be, in three places at the same time." Only 5 months had passed since my father had died, and suddenly we all missed him so much that something happened that I don't normally associate with my family. Silence. Finally, it was time to go home, and as we started to walk down the hill, my mother had one last question.
Well, who's going to stay? I know Fred does not like to be alone.
I forgot to tell you something important. Nobody from my family was living on that property anymore. In the early 70s, my grandmother, who was at that point too old to live by herself, moved to Los Angeles, and a string of tenants, none of them very interested in taking care of something they didn't own, lived in that house. And whenever I'd come to Arizona, I'd make sure to drive by the place to see how it was doing. Every time I saw the house, a few more roof shingles were missing, and maybe a few concrete steps had cracked in half. The house seemed to be slowly sinking back into the ground. When it came to what to do with the place, everybody had a fantasy. We could turn it into a great day spa. The house could be restored. We could take turns vacationing there. But the fact was that it would take so much time and money to fix it. That truth paralyzed my family. One day, 2 years after that, my Uncle Abe, who still lived in Nogales, sold the entire estate to a local businessman. I don't know about anybody else in my family, but I was shocked. Suddenly, it was no longer ours to love and ignore. We were still allowed to visit, but when we went there, we were interlopers who'd received permission to walk on the parcel of desert that held not just childhood memories, but something tangible, an actual part of my father. I forgot something else. I forgot to describe to you what this land looked like. To us, what the land lacked in classic postcard beauty, it made up for in these vast, uninterrupted views. It had a sort of romantic, rugged, frontier cowboy quality. But if you saw it, you might not have felt the same way. It was 22 rolling acres of sun-beaten beige desolation. Nothing flourished in the loose desert soil but some native grass and the occasional cholla cactus. So keep that in mind, because 5 years ago, something happened, something amazing. My cousin David called me, and he told me to get on a plane. There was something I had to see.
And I've been coming down here, of course, since I was a child, and we've been living here 32 years. And I've never seen anything close to that, so immediately I had to call you.
Within 24 hours, I was in a car bouncing up the rutted dirt driveway with a bunch of my cousins. Nothing could have prepared me for the sight that awaited us. Instead of dry grass and cactus, as far as the eye could see, there were wildflowers. Wildflowers everywhere.
Wow. Look at that.
That's so cool.
It's amazing.
It's crazy.
I know.
There were brilliant orange poppies, wild purple heliotrope, and these fragile clusters of pink fluff called fairy dusters. To me, it was as if the location of a John Ford Western had suddenly been transformed to shoot The Sound of Music.
I feel like Dorothy, we're going to be like all really drowsy.
We slowly made our way up to the summit, up to Lookout Rock.
Well, Fred Rocklin, 1923-2002, was born and raised on this land when it was a 20-acre tract called the Rocklin Heights. And he would be amazed to see this today.
There at the base of my father's headstone, settled in a nest of fuzzy green leaves, was a delicate flower. It was pink, with a stripe of vibrant yellow in its interior. I hate to use the word magical, but that's sort of how it felt. How did it grow in the middle of the dry Arizona desert? There was a single fluted blossom that looked like an orchid, something you'd expect to see on a corsage or stuck in a bride's hair.
Here it is, evening primrose, maybe.
I
sprigs there.
Can't get over it.
You have to see it to believe it is.
As we were slowly making our way down the hill, we saw a glint of something across the canyon. It was the Border Patrol checking us out with high-powered binoculars. One of my cousins suddenly lifted up her shirt.
Hi, boys!
Put your shirt down. How do you know that they're watching us?
They're just watching everything.
What did they think was going on? Maybe they were just bored. What I did discover was that most of the flowers were Arizona poppies. It's a summer annual that looks like a five-petaled poppy, but is actually a close relative of the creosote bush. The Latin name is Calostromia grandiflora.
Calostromia grandiflora in full flower, masses of it.
I found this out from George Montgomery.
I'm the curator of botany here at the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum, and I'm in my 31st year of working here.
I tracked him down to help me figure out how the wildflowers got there. He told me that a combination of an extended summer monsoon season and high temperatures had awakened seeds that had lain dormant for decades.
Several years of drought, greater accumulation of some seed stock, and then the abundant summer rains that year allowed all these dormant seeds to germinate and created just the right conditions for extensive Calostromia flowering that year.
He also said that what happened on my grandmother's land happened everywhere that summer.
We were seeing these calostromias throughout southern Arizona, and your photographs of the Nogales area were some of the more massive showings that we saw.
The more he talked, the more it felt not so magic.
Moisture in the ground.
He even had an explanation for the orchid.
What you're calling an orchid was a devil's claw, is the name of it, and can grow in these micro niches. By a boulder like this, an outcropping of rock can be a rainfall gatherer, so to speak, a micro habitat.
But I still had so many questions. Like, why was the display on our hill so much more spectacular than anything else in the surrounding area? His parched clinical explanation for everything had begun to deflate me. So 7 years pass, and I was in Nogales, and I drove to my grandmother's property with one of my cousins. The wildflowers were gone, and it had returned to its original state of dry beige grass interrupted by rocks.
You can see they cut a road down here. I guess they were going to build a house there.
This canyon, I know my grandmother's house had been in wobbly disrepair for at least a decade, but the new owner didn't just tear it down. It was like he'd erased it from the property. Nothing was left, not even a brick.
There's where the house was, right there where those dead trees are. The lot is totally leveled. They tore that all up.
For as long as I could remember, there was the steep, bumpy road that led to the house, a sort of dirt roller coaster that was part of the excitement of visiting my grandmother. But the new owner had closed it off. Now there was a new road that wound straight back just a few steps away from Lookout Rock. The plaque was still there.
Let me see if this is still... Yeah, well, it's a little bit rocky, but it's not coming out.
And right down there was where that orchid was, right?
Right, that's right, yeah.
Wow. One of the things that George Montgomery had told me was that if there had been a history of wildfires on the land, it might have contributed to that intense carpet of summer poppies that had sprung up in 2006. Frequent burning would keep plants like grasses from growing, and there would be less competition for sunlight, space, and water. Well, it turns out that either I come from a long line of pyromaniacs or people who just don't understand how fire works.
Oh, I know what I wanted to ask you. Now, have you ever set fire to this hill?
Oh, yeah. It was probably midsummer, tall grass, absolutely parched, wind blowing. I was probably 8 or 9 or 10. I got some wooden matches and lit a little fire, which instantly, because of the winds and the dry conditions, turned into an absolute inferno. And I tried stamping it out, and then I got really freaked out because this property is 22 acres. It pretty much went through the 22 acres really fast. And then it jumped the road and started burning across the road, and then it jumped over here. So the whole hillside was aflame. So I ran to the house, and I called Mr. Jackson, and I was terrified. I thought, oh, I am in so much trouble. And Mr. Jackson came and got out the hose and hosed down what he could. It didn't burn down the house, of course. And I was just crying, and I was so scared. And Mr. Jackson said, listen, David, your mother burnt down this hill. Your Uncle Freddie burnt down this hill. Your grandfather burnt down this hill. Your other uncles burnt down this hill. That was pretty much it. And really, to tell you the truth, I didn't catch too much hell when everybody came home because they'd all been there.
Remember my father's love of big questions? Well, I have a few big questions of my own. Why am I obsessed with a piece of property that is located 500 miles from where I live? Why do I act like it's somehow the glue that binds my family together? Why did I think that if it was ever sold, that we would no longer have a center?
When you're so familiar with a particular piece of property, a particular area, and then you see it in a way that you've never seen it before, you know, we'll probably never see it again like that.
What happened on my grandmother's land means different things to different people. To George Montgomery, it's a statistic. The sudden presence of wildflowers was just as interesting to him as the years when nothing grew, because together they provide an answer to some much bigger scientific question. And to my family, it's now a part of our shared history, a story to be told to those who didn't get to see the event with their own eyes. Or maybe It has more to do with something that my aunt, my father's older sister, said back then. We had just come back from my grandmother's hill, and we were showing my aunt some pictures we had taken, and we were wondering how this incredible transformation had occurred. And she said to me, "Maybe your father just wanted to see some poppies."
That was writer Margie Rockland. Thanks for listening. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Stizzy Montgomery.